Greetings and welcome to the first DonationCoder.com audio radio show podcast. This is Mouser, and I'll be your host for today's show. And today we've got a eclectic collection of random segments from people you know on the forum. And we're going to start out with Zane's rant on Crippleware.
Hi, this is Zane Ritlin with the Great Software List, where I look at software from the user's point of view. Here's a gripe I have with tech, and it's the same one with business. A word like free doesn't really mean free at all. Here's an example. I did a Google search today for free wave recorders, and it called up the free download center website, which, as you guessed it, lists mostly shareware. Hey, but the downloads are free. Somewhere along the line, a handful of developers got the idea that free only applies to downloading the trial version. Like, my poor fat butt is going to pay to download your software to try it out. Think again, man. Software involves commitment, at least a time commitment. And if I can't freely evaluate your software, then I'd rather not do so at all, because I can't afford to buy before I try. I'm already eating the cheapest macaroni on the shelf and paying $3.40 for gas. Cheap macaroni doesn't give me the energy, much less the cash, to buy your software without seeing if it works the way you claim it does. Then there's Crippleware. You know, Crippleware is a trial version of shareware that either won't save your file or it'll only perform a few simple functions until you purchase the full version. This week I wanted to test Clone Master, which is a duplicate file finder. But I couldn't because, get this, a duplicate file finder would not delete duplicates. The trial version of Clone Master was so crippled that it wouldn't delete duplicates, any duplicates. What kind of sick joke is that? If you're a developer that offers crippled trial versions to users, then just finish the moon pie, step away from the keyboard, and go work as a telemarketer, because, frankly, that sucks. Crippleware is not about protecting copyrights or losing money. It's about inconveniencing others. No matter how good you think your program is, if you have to cripple it before anybody can see how it works, I can guarantee that your software isn't worth my time anyway. Otherwise, you'd want the world to see it. Users can't afford to pay to try out software. There's far too many good alternatives out there. So here's a secret. The best developers want users to test their software. They want honest, critical feedback, and they want passionate users, users who like the software they've chosen among all the others. That's the way it should be. For DonationCoder.com, I'm Zane Ridling.
For this week's show, we asked people to send us their first recollections of using a computer. So let's hear what some of them said.
Hi, this is April, otherwise known as App on the Forums in the IRC channel. The first time I ever used a computer. Well, first you have to know, I'm Daddy's little girl and Daddy was a programmer. So wanting to follow in his footsteps, I signed up for a programming class my freshman year of high school. The computer was some donated mini computer from Apple with about 15 terminals that ran multi-user BASIC. I loved the class and planned on making programming my career. But then some unfortunate things happened, and things didn't quite turn out the way I had planned. And I never touched a computer again. Until one day, about 7 years ago, my father showed up at my house with his old P1 that ran Windows 98. He handed it to me and said, "Here, you need this." I thought he was nuts. Then he gave me a very confusing crash course in Windows and went home. I sat there staring at it for about 10 minutes, afraid to touch it out of fear I might break it. And finally, I started clicking a few shortcuts on the quick launch, followed by clicking all the menu buttons that said help. About an hour later, I called up my father for the all-important question, "How do you turn this damn thing off?" I think I called him every day for the next 3 days to ask him that, but he was right, I did need it. It opened up a whole new world for me and became a very important part of my life. The use of that computer brought back all the old feelings and dreams that I had swept under the rug many years before. It allowed me to finally be who I was on the inside, who I wanted to be, a programmer. It took 20 years for me to get my life back on track, and I have my dad and that old P1 to thank for it. By the way, I still have that old P1, and I'll keep it forever. It's like a member of the family to me. I named it Ed, but that's another story.
I think a lot of us were probably first exposed to a computer through our fathers. And I remember when my father would take me to the computer shows, and this was probably around 1978, and I would always go straight for the computers that could play games. And you know, at this time there weren't many games, but you know, you could get Star Trek game and you know, Asteroids or whatever. So I would always look for the computers with games, and I remember when my father was trying to decide what computer to buy, you know, lobbying for a PET or whatever. There were a couple computers there that had some games. And my father went right for the Cromemco Z2D, which was this giant machine with a terminal. And one of the principal deciding factors for this computer was that it had no games. None. It was a CPM machine, and no one would even dare write a game for this machine. And but it wasn't out of spite that he did this. It was actually a very brilliant plan. And what happened was that because there were no games to buy for this computer, I had to learn how to write games. And we bought two books that turned out to be very meaningful books for me, and I still have a very fond place in my heart for these books. And these were the Basic Computer Games by David Ahl, who used to write for Creative Computing. And I'm guessing there are a lot of kids of my age that sort of cut their teeth on that book, and it had listings of lots of computer games in BASIC that you could type in, and they were taken from the pages of Creative Computing. And that's how a lot of us played games in those days. You'd get your computer magazine, and you'd look for a fun game, and there was the listing of the game. There were no attached CDs like you find them now, with demos in the back. In those days, you would type in your game.
Just the remix.
This time, a little joke. Some American IT specialists have created a new supercomputer. It was especially built for analyzing war scenarios and calculate the best strategy for the situation. A general from the Marines was interested in the computer and arrived at the lab where the computer stands. He said to the ITs,
"I want to prove if the computer really finds the best tactic for a situation, so enter the following scenario. Assume a battlefield of 2 square miles. At the northern end, there are about 1,000 well-armed enemy soldiers. In the south, there are about 500 of our men without any weapon. So, what to do now? Shall we attack? Stay there and entrench? Or better retreat?"
The computer thinks a while, and then say,
"Yes."
The general grumbles angry,
"Yes, what?"
Computer,
"Yes, sir."
Hi, this is Dave Ozan recording from Boise, Idaho. And the first time I remember using a computer was when I was very young. I'm not sure how old I was. And I don't remember what kind of computer it was, but I think it was still called an IBM in those days. And the monitor only showed one color, which was green. Anyway, I used the computer to play a game called Ladder, in which the object of the game was to get from the bottom of the screen to the top by climbing ladders, jumping over platforms, avoiding enemies, etc. It was a pretty fun game, and my brother actually made a clone of it, which he called Jump, and he added some additional features such as multiplayer, and it was pretty fun to relive the days of Ladder in my later years. Anyway, that's my first memory of computers.
Hello, this is Jojo from Germany speaking. Concerning the question of the month, I can tell you the following. I found myself the first time in front of a Taylorix computer with only a single LED line display when I was a 16-year-old commercial apprentice. That was in 1979. I was so fascinated by the technology that I bought myself in the same year my first own programmable calculator, a Sharp 1302, with, believe it or not, gigantic 300 bytes of memory. After another year, I was addicted to computers, and fortunately, the first affordable real computer was on sale. A Commodore VC20. While time passes, I changed first to a C64, then an Amiga 500, and Amiga 4000. And then, after Commodore was insolvent, I switched to a PC with a Pentium 90. Many PCs come and go in my home the next years, and today I work in a software company as a software developer, still using PCs, for now nearly 20 years. Many greetings to all Donation Coder members from Johto in Germany.
And now we're going to hear from House Tier on emotions or SCO or Grocklaw or something. See if you can figure it out.
Hello, this is Horst here from Germany. Today we talk about emotions. It is no secret that some people hate other people. However, different people express their feelings in different ways. Some of these people even run a big company. So let's focus on one of these companies, the SCO Group, formerly known as Caldera, formerly known as Santa Cruz Operation, formerly known as whatever. No one knows, not even themselves. So it came to pass that one of the hater people became CEO of the SCO Group and decided to sue the rest of the world because they didn't like Linux people. Since this was a very stupid reason to engage in litigations, the SCO Group claimed Linux was infringing their precious intellectual property. They sued AutoZone, Daimler Chrysler, Novell, and IBM. The IBM case gets the most attention. Enter Grocklaw. On the internet at groklaw.net. That's groklaw.net. Run by Pamela Jones, this site is dedicated to shed the light of truth on these many litigations and motions and accusations and allegations. SCO was going out of control, but Grocklaw wasn't. Actually, sometimes users go insane and post more than 500 comments on a single story. But more on that later. Grocklaw has been about shortly after the litigations began, which is several years ago. This long-going battle is subject to many, many complaints by Grocklaw visitors. Its members sit at court hearings and later report to the site, so we get first-hand information about what's going on. Most often, however, the legal documents which are filed back and forth are copied and made available as text by many busy helpers. Pamela Jones then writes a story about it and people can start posting comments and asking questions. For each story, there is so much to read, it's exhausting to follow up. Especially when the Grocklaw folks have a good run and just keep posting and posting and posting. That way, everything is covered, from paralegal and personal opinions to speculations, from thorough analysis to innocent questions, from rants about the slow United States court system to latest news picks about other topics. It is a very lively community with dedicated people. There are all kinds of people, some with a legal background. But everybody makes sure to not give legal advice, only personal opinions. IANAL is the most common abbreviation to be found there. It means, I am not a lawyer. This whole mess started several years ago, and it will probably last a few more. I think rock and roll will be around much longer than that. There are, sadly, a lot of these hater people around. I don't think rock and roll will run out of cases to cover. In fact, other cases are already being covered and followed as closely as the SCO versus IBM case. What makes this case so special is the fact that even after 3 years of discovery, we still don't know what it is about. We haven't seen any evidence yet. SCO did show something like evidence to show copyright infringement. However, it turned out the piece of code they displayed originally came from BSD, to which SCO holds no copyright whatsoever. Many Groglaw members are eager to see the millions of lines of code that SCO claimed exist within the Linux kernel. But to this day, SCO has not made any such information publicly available. In Germany, SCO was forbidden to keep claiming that Linux infringed their copyright until they showed evidence. They have yet to provide this evidence to the German courts. A few more words about what makes Groglaw great, and then I am done. Groglaw is not so much against SCO or Microsoft, as they are for the truth and wholesome information. Minority opinions are not deleted, only insults are removed. At last, a word of warning. Reading the stories and comments absolutely will take a lot of time, really. Alright, this was my first review of one of the greatest sites on the net. See you next time.
Portion of the DC podcast, the first ever DC podcast, and my name is Aram, and I am otherwise known as Superboy AC on the forums, and I like to complain about things, and since I've been given permission to do that, then I'm not going to turn that down. So the first thing I'm going to talk about today are user interfaces and how much 90% of them bug me. And the whole problem with most of the user interfaces that I see is that they're always trying to be this wannabe Mac kind of look where everything's bubbly and shiny. And the biggest problem of all this is that everything is just too big and they don't make use of the space, you know? The monitors keep getting bigger and bigger, and I increase my resolution, you know, 1024, 1200 something, I don't know, I keep making it bigger, I make my font smaller, but these applications get so big and bulky and rounded corners and all sorts of stuff that just take up space but don't add any kind of functionality to the program. So these things really bug the hell out of me. And I think that one of the biggest abusers of this is the skins that comes with Winamp. You know, so Winamp has made it possible for everyone to skin the software, and they give... So everyone and their grandma comes in with one of these skins, and they make it so big and bulky, and they make it look like something that they think people would want to use. But it's not really practical. I don't need a big 800 pixel play button in the middle of my monitor. I just want to press play half the time when using my keyboard anyway. I just want Winamp running in the background. And that brings me to the other problem with all these interfaces. Like, how do you dock some of these windows that have the rounded corners, or if it's like a trapezoid shape, or if it's an oval, you know, where am I going to put this on the monitor? I can't put it in the corner, I can't if I put it here, you know, so I'm sitting there, I'm confused, I don't know where I'm going to put anything. So I just get frustrated, I turn the damn program off. Anyway, so that's my main gripe with user interfaces. Let's keep it simple, practical, functional, but let's not get out of control. Let's make use of the space and keep things the way it should be, which is practical functionality. That's what we got to think about. And that's the software portion of this rant. But I was just watching TV a couple minutes ago, and I saw those stupid IBM Blue people you know, they have their face painted blue, like their skin painted blue, and they just kind of look at you with these bug eyes. And I don't see what the appeal of these things are. Who likes these people? I heard they go to Vegas and they put on a show. Why would I watch this show? They look kind of creepy to me. Just stare at you. I could do that. Paint myself some color and just stare at you. People are going to freak out. But then, my dad, he always tells me to keep things positive. And this is not really a positive discussion I'm having here. So I'll end with something positive, and that's Reese's Pieces Pastel Eggs. If you guys haven't seen these, there's for Easter, Reese's Pieces comes out with these special edition Reese's Pieces, which is essentially Reese's Pieces on steroids. They got huge Reese's Pieces, and they're the same candy, except they're like three times as big and filled with that creamy peanut butter. It's the greatest thing in the world. I went to the store after Easter. I do this every year. And since they're half price, I kind of cleaned them out. So I got about a year's worth of Reese's Pieces Pastel Eggs to last me until next Easter. Anyway, that's it for me. Thanks to Mouser for putting together this site. I think it's a great site. You know, it gives me a chance to complain about a lot of things that I wouldn't complain about. And, I'm even surprised that some of the authors of some of these softwares actually come by and listen to me, when other people just look at me like I'm kind of crazy. So that's it. I hear the music playing. That means it's time for me to go. Talk to you guys later.
Well, that wraps it up for the first DonationCoder.com audio radio show podcast. And we'd like to thank everyone who participated this month, especially Superboy AC for his music, Cody's theme, which we use throughout the program. And we'll see you all next month.